The downturn in the U.S.-China relationship and the COVID-19 pandemic has fueled sharp increases in anti-Asian rhetoric and hate crimes. Specifically, almost half of all hate crimes reported to Stop AAPI Hate from 2020 to 2022 targeted Chinese Americans, who make up 24% of the Asian American population and are one of the fastest growing population groups in the United States and the largest Asian origin group. Yet, data on the reality of day-to-day life in the United States for Chinese Americans have been limited. Most nationally representative surveys report only on Asian Americans as a whole, or only cover one or two narrow focus areas. To fill this gap in knowledge, the Committee of 100 and Columbia University administered a comprehensive survey late last year to highlight the demographic backgrounds, political opinions and engagement, and health and economic status of Chinese Americans. My name is Yuhua Tran, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Joining me today to share key findings from the survey and its implications for increased equity and inclusion of Chinese Americans are Zheng Yu Z. Huang from the Committee of 100 and Qing Gao from Columbia University. Z and Qing, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Z is the president of Committee of 100, a nonpartisan leadership organization of prominent Chinese Americans in business, government, academia, and the arts. The committee's mission is to promote the full participation of all Chinese Americans in American society and act as a public policy resource for the Chinese American community and advance constructive dialogue and relationships between the peoples and leaders of the United States and Greater China. Qing is a professor of social policy and social work at Columbia, associate dean for doctoral education at the School of Social Work, and the founding director of the university's China Center for Social Policy. Z, can you start by sharing why data like that collected by this Chinese American survey is necessary or useful? What does the Committee of 100 hope to accomplish by implementing this survey?
As we all know today, there's a lot of emotions around U.S.-China relations and the impact that it has on the Asian American community, in particular the Chinese American community. But emotions and stories are important, but not sufficient. And even though the stories abound, we don't really have concrete data that shed light on the challenges, the obstacles, and the opportunities that affect the 5 million Chinese Americans living in America. So we're very happy to partner with Columbia to really look into the responses from our broader community on these key issues that may have implication above and beyond our own community as well.
Thanks, Z, for sharing that. Qing, over to you. What were the main challenges that you and your team had to consider and address as you were designing the survey?
Thank you. We have been so honored and happy to partner with the Committee of 100 to conduct this survey. We named this survey the State of Chinese American Survey because our goal was to provide a comprehensive picture about this population that's rapidly growing. And we don't know a whole lot about the Chinese American community. So the first challenge we encountered, which was an exciting one, was to design this questionnaire to be able to capture the main aspects of the Chinese American population. So we drew from a variety of literature and we consulted a number of other surveys to really get the key questions on the key domains of cultural identity, of the sense of belonging to American society, of health, economic situations, social engagement, and political engagement. So we wanted to be sure we capture all these key elements to provide a baseline of our understanding of the Chinese American population. Of course, once we launched the survey, another challenge is to how to get to the people, right? We want to capture the diverse Chinese American population in the survey. So we wanted to use recruitment strategies to reach all demographic groups within this population and to make sure we reach the harder to reach subgroups in this population. So again, there, our partnership with Committee of 100 was very powerful because together we had this national network of over 100 community organizations. So they helped us promote this survey and reach out to their local communities. So we were able to include a very diverse group of participants in our survey.
Can you share with us, Ching, the survey's main demographic findings? And I'm also curious to know, did any of the findings surprise you?
So we really started by setting some goals because we wanted to capture the very diverse Chinese American population in this survey. So we actually first started with the American Community Survey demographic distributions. So we wanted to make sure that our survey would reflect the different age groups, gender groups, regional distribution, English proficiency level, etc. of this population. And in the end, we applied the statistical weights so that our demographic distribution would mimic the national distribution based on the American Community Survey, which is done by the Census Bureau, so that it's reflective of the composition of the Chinese Americans. So in our survey, we had about half, 49% from the West region, followed by 26% from the Northeast region. And then we had 16% from the South and 9% from the Midwest. So again, we wanted to ensure that we had national representation from all the main regions. One thing that's surprising to me and to my team is that we assumed that our findings will show a very diverse Chinese American population. Well, we saw a huge diversity reflected through our survey. So for example, in terms of place of birth, our survey showed over half, 52%, said they were born in mainland China, followed by 27% who were born in the US. And then 8% were born in Hong Kong, 6% born in Taiwan, and 7% other born in other places around the world. However, we also asked people, where were you living at age 12 as a measure of place of upbringing? For that one, we see that 44% said they were brought up at age 12 in mainland China, which is a lower percentage compared to where they were born in terms of born in mainland China. And 41%, a much bigger proportion, were brought up in the US. So again, we see the shifts and dynamics and also the diversity. One other example I would give you in terms of the diversity is language spoken at home. We really see a multilingual population for Chinese Americans. At home, nearly half spoke English, and either it's English by itself or English in combination with another or sometimes two or three more languages. We also saw that nearly 40% spoke two or more languages at home. So just linguistically, it's a very diverse population.
I know that the survey also asked about a feeling of being accepted in American society. Given the diversity that you just mentioned, I'm wondering if you found any correlations between English proficiency and place of birth or upbringing and that feeling of being accepted in American society.
Overall, we found that the majority of our study participants felt accepted in American society. So in total, 77% said they felt belonging, a sense of being accepted in American society. And that percentage was higher if we asked whether they felt accepted in Asian American society, which was 88%, and whether they had a sense of being accepted in the Chinese American society, which was 90%. We also looked at cultural blendedness, so whether they felt a part of the combined culture, and that's 87%. Over 80% also said they felt they were moving between two cultures, so a sense of cultural harmony. At the same time, 58% said they felt conflicted between American and Chinese ways of doing things, so a sense of cultural conflict alongside the cultural blendedness and harmony. When we looked at these measures by English proficiency level and place of birth, surprisingly, the sense of belonging or feeling accepted were not hugely different when we talk about being accepted in American society or Asian American society. Only that those who had less English proficiency or who were born outside of US were a little bit more likely to feel a higher sense of being accepted in Chinese American society. This group also had a little bit more cultural conflict than those who had higher English proficiency or were born in the US. But again, the differences were not huge. So this overwhelming sense of acceptance and belonging was a kind of a surprise to us too. So our population feel they're part of America, they belong, while navigating the cultures and conflicts, and also, as our survey showed, a high level of racial discrimination that they have to endure despite the high sense of acceptance.
Thanks, Ching, for sharing that. And it's encouraging to hear about the high percentage of feeling accepted in American society. But you mentioned also the problem of racism. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit more about the survey's finding on experiences with racism.
This is one of the very sobering findings we were able to reveal with this survey. We knew going into the survey that racial discrimination and hate incidents toward Chinese Americans and Asian Americans broadly were high, but still our findings really have been so sobering. So overall, close to 3 in 4, 74% of the Chinese American participants in our study experienced at least one kind of racial discrimination in the past 12 months. That's very high. We also looked at different forms of racial discrimination and hate incidents. So for example, we found that 27% in our study experienced either a verbal harassment or physical intimidation or assault, or had people making a racial slur or call them a name. So that's very high, 27%. We also had what we call everyday discrimination measures. So people felt that other people acted as if they were afraid of them, or they were treated unfairly in restaurants or stores, or they felt they were treated with less respect than other people. That's over half. So 51% of people felt they were treated unfairly or experienced this kind of racial discrimination in daily life. And lastly, this really troubles me a lot, is that it's not only the actual experiences of these hate incidents and the discrimination, it's the worries and the mental burden posed on the Chinese Americans. Over 60%, so 2 in 3 people in our study said they worried about safety for themselves and their families, and they had to stay vigilant during the past 12 months. So these measures include they felt unease in public areas or worried about how other people might look at them. They tried to avoid certain social situations or places because of the concerns about being subject to racial discrimination. And then they worried about their family members or themselves being victims of hate crimes or harassment. So these mental health burdens are severe, and it actually affects economic opportunities. In our open-ended questions, people provided narratives to tell us they had to change their work schedule. They had to avoid transportation in certain hours to change their work schedule because of the fears of racial discrimination. So both the mental health burden and economic cost are worrisome to us.
Those are definitely very sobering statistics and sobering narratives to hear. Related to the issue of health, and I know the survey also covered this, can you share a little bit on the survey's key findings, not just on mental health, but on the health of Chinese Americans in general?
We really set out to understand the health, both physical and mental health, of the Chinese American population, because often this group is stereotyped to be the model minority, right? They are doing well. But it's not entirely true. And many members of this community suffer from different kinds of challenges, disadvantages, and hardships. So we did look into the health in different dimensions. So for example, we saw from our survey that 1 in 4 Chinese Americans had at least one form of health disadvantage. These include whether they felt they had poor or fair physical or mental health, or they had a type of disability. In our study, about 10% reported having one or more forms of disability. These include physical, developmental, or mental disability, and also 4% didn't want to share about their disability status, which is related to the stigma and the fear of being known as a disabled person in this community. We also asked about subjective well-being, so capturing both the risks for mental illness and also life satisfaction in general. Again, the results are sobering. We found that nearly 1 in 4 Chinese Americans were either at moderate or severe risks of mental illness. And about a quarter, about 1 in 3 reported low to moderate life satisfaction. So these are measures of subjective well-being that are probably going alongside the physical health measures. So we need to look deeper into the health measures and outcomes and actually their needs for health-related services.
On well-being, data shows that the Asian American community in general and as a whole is experiencing a mental health crisis. Mental illness is on the rise, and Asian American adolescents have the highest rate of suicidal ideation of any racial ethnic group. Z, based on the survey responses of Chinese Americans, do you think this to be the reality among Chinese Americans as well? What do you think are the primary factors contributing to mental health issues?
Chinese Americans are Americans, so they deal with the same set of issues that all Americans deal with. You know, rising inflation, security at home and abroad, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the Chinese American community probably deals with a couple things that, you know, the average American doesn't have to think about. You know, this idea that they're the perpetual foreigner, that no matter how many generations they're here, they're still considered a stranger in their own homeland. Or the second that, you know, they're a model minority, so they have no problems and shouldn't speak up where they face challenges, health, financial, otherwise, that Qing had talked about, you know, or given the rise in tension between US and China, being seen as a potential spy, somebody that has dual loyalty and may not be trusted, or even worse, a carrier of a disease. So I think the last few stereotypes are specifically what Chinese Americans have to deal with in addition, you know, to the daily challenges and grinds.
I can add a little bit based on our survey, which goes back to what we covered earlier about the sense of cultural conflict, right? When we compare the first generation versus the second generation. So in our study, among those who are US born, so who are born in this country, 45% felt this cultural conflict. But among those who were born outside of the US, that percentage is 55%. So we see a 10 percentage point difference. The cultural conflict, the American and Chinese ways of doing things, probably partly through parental expectations, navigating between tradition, culture, and also the so-called mainstream ways of doing things. I think that contributes to this tension and the potential mental health. On the other hand, I want to say that our community with these new survey results are becoming aware of this mental health crisis and challenge. There are a lot more grassroots organizations who are speaking up to raise awareness about mental health and also to share resources. So I work at a school of social work. Many of our students, we are training them to provide bilingual, bicultural, culturally sensitive and competent services to support these families, because these kind of resources and support need to be nuanced and to connect with them culturally and sometimes linguistically so that they can be brave enough to speak up and seek the help they need. And then we can also lobby on a grander scale for the services that this community desperately needs.
Thank you, Z and Qing, both of you, for sharing your thoughts. Z, earlier you mentioned the impact that the deterioration in the U.S.-China relationship has had on the mental health of Chinese Americans. Can you share a little bit more on how that deterioration has affected the day-to-day lives of Chinese in the United States?
Just speaking personally, you know, I have been accosted by strangers on the street
telling me to go back to China. I know members of ours whose families trace back generations in America have been called and asked to do the same. And we know this is not isolated, but rather quite prevalent. And this is a very direct consequence in the deterioration in relations. Beyond the personal anecdotes, things get a lot worse. We know that under the failed China initiative, under President Trump, there has been thousands of Chinese scientists that have been falsely accused, prosecuted. Many of them were eventually exonerated in the courts. But the sad thing is many of their lives, financial, otherwise, were ruined. In addition to that, because of the fear in a resurgent China, we're beginning to see states, Florida was the first one, passing alien land acts, reminiscent of the same alien land acts that banned the Chinese and Japanese from owning land just 100 years ago. And these acts basically stipulate that if you look Chinese or look Asian, you might be questioned if you're able to even purchase a house, a home, land in America. This is beyond the typical, you know, microaggressions. We have now seen, unfortunately, state-led prosecution of anything that smacks of China. And unfortunately, Chinese Americans, you know, we're the only people who look Chinese in this country.
On these proposed state legislation to ban Chinese immigrants from purchasing land, and in the case of Florida, the past legislation, what can be done to counter these kinds of acts?
Well, we have to understand that as citizens, we have to speak up for our own rights. And we have to find allies to speak up together, because I sincerely believe that America suffers when, in a zeal to protect itself, it makes mistakes harming the civil liberties of its citizens. What happened to the Japanese Americans during World War II is a blemish on our history. And today, the same blemishes might be happening again. So as citizens, we have the right to speak up, not just to protect ourselves, but for the good and the conscience and the values of this country. So I think when Chinese Americans speak up, we speak up for all Americans.
Thanks, Zee. I couldn't agree more. And so what comes next then? Now that you are armed with these data, what actions or next steps are the Committee of 100 or Columbia University planning to take?
From our side, I think when we go see policymakers in DC, it's not enough to just bring the personal stories. They want to know data, right? They want to know how a large population is affected. And so this data is very powerful to show them the challenges, the opportunities, and the obstacles that our community faces.
We are so excited about completing this round of the data collection and producing a powerful report. We still have very rich data to delve deeper into. So for example, earlier we talked about the intersectionality between English proficiency, income level, or birthplace, and these health measures. We can look deeper into how these different kinds of disadvantages could overlap so that some of our community members really are at a greater disadvantage than others, and what resources and support are needed to lift them up. So that's one thing. The other is, in this round of the survey, we ask people whether they would be willing to be contacted again for a future wave of the survey. Over half said they're willing, and they share their contact information when we are ready. So we have a great potential to conduct a longitudinal survey to follow these people to see whether their conditions and thoughts would change over time, so that we can provide this, not only the snapshot, but a dynamic picture to see how things evolve. That will also give us the opportunity to add new questions or tweak the existing questions to understand people's experiences and opinions in more detail. And lastly, in this survey, we had a few open-ended questions where we invited people to share their thoughts and experiences, and we got a rich number of responses. But going forward, we can do more. We can collect some life stories. Some of our members represent just a rich array of different experiences and input to what could be done. So we're eager to undertake more research to understand the lives and thoughts and basically the overview of the Chinese American population. And we hope to be able to continue to provide the knowledge and evidence to inform policies going forward.
I want to give you both the opportunity to share any final thoughts on anything from the survey that we haven't already covered. Qing, maybe we'll start with you and then over to Z.
Thank you so much. It's been a great honor and pleasure to be on this program today. May is AAPI Heritage Month. I'm very happy we're having this conversation now. Through this survey, what I felt was that the Chinese American population had such a high sense of belonging and being accepted. So we belong and we matter. So we are part of this society. And as Z said, we should speak up. We should voice our opinions. We should vote and we should lobby to change unfair, unjust policies and practices. And we should engage in more dialogue, not only within our community, but across communities so that we can build alliance. We can make positive changes together. And it's all for the better future of the United States and maybe for the world, because we talked about the U.S. relation tensions, how that affects people's lives negatively. So I think the more we do, the more we speak up, things will be better.
I just want to quickly add on a point that Qinghai mentioned early on, which is this is a very innovative methodology that allows us to do disaggregated data. Now, the AAPI community is comprised of more than 50 plus subgroups, Chinese, Koreans, Hmong, Vietnamese, etc., etc. It's also true for the Latino community and for the African-American community. In fact, America is such a diverse set of communities that most times these subgroups don't get any attention because it's too expensive to gather data. A traditional methodology using fully randomized sampling would cost $4 to $5 million, if not more. So not very replicable. So this time, the methodology that we employed working with Qing and her team is very innovative. We worked with over 100 Chinese American groups across the United States. Yes, it's not completely randomized, but due to some of the good work that Qing has done and some of the outreach, we specifically target underrepresented groups and we use scientific methodologies such as weighting and otherwise, which Qing can, I'm sure, can explain more. We're able to have very good sense of the broader issues concerning our community. So the beauty with this methodology is it's much, much cheaper, much, much more engaging, and much, much more likely to be replicated. And so I think this survey has also demonstrated that a more cost-effective, community-engaged survey methodology is possible, not just for the Chinese American community, but for all sub-communities within the United States.
Z and Qing, thank you both so much for taking the time today to share these data and your thoughts on the ramifications of what we now know about the state of Chinese Americans. As a Chinese American myself, thank you for the work that you and your colleagues are doing for our communities and for your important contributions towards creating a more tolerant and equitable society for all of us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and Spotify, where you can follow our conversations. As always, thank you for listening.